Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, a weekly news magazine produced by Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul. Today we'll look at a controversial casino proposed for Medford, Oregon. We'll hear how mentally ill inmates in Washington languish for months in jail waiting for competency hearings. Rachel McDonald will report on how the University of Oregon may have violated a student's right to privacy. An attempt to ban greyhound racing in Oregon is having trouble reaching the finish line. And a federal judge has sided with environmental groups and the Spokane Indian Tribe over pollution in the Spokane River. That's coming up on The Bridge. But first, these news headlines. You're listening to The Bridge. I'm David Paul. The proposal by the Coquille Indian Tribe to build a new casino in Medford, Oregon, has taken heat from all sides ever since it surfaced in 2012. Federal, state, and local elected officials have lined up against it. The Cow Creek Indian Tribe is adamantly opposed, and comments from the public at large have been overwhelmingly negative. Jefferson Public Radio's Liam Moriarty looks at some of the complexities that make this such a contentious debate.
I'm standing just off Route 99 in South Medford, across the highway from the headquarters of Harry and David, the gourmet fruit company. Right in front of me is Roxy Ann Lane's, a 24-lane bowling center. If the Coquille Indians have their way, it'll be remodeled into a casino that would feature a restaurant and more than 600 electronic gambling machines. With me is Judy Metcalf, CEO of the Coquille's Economic Development Company.
We're really hoping to make this a great facility that Medford residents are proud of, that can provide safe entertainment for adults.
Metcalf says the 4.5-acre property is ideal.
We have great visibility, access, parking, and we're just contributing to the economic growth of South Medford.
The Coquille already have one casino on their reservation near Coos Bay. Tribal officials say a new casino in Medford will provide needed economic development to fund the tribe's health, housing, and other social programs. But in February, at a crowded public hearing in Medford held by the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, several dozen speakers, including area residents Barbara Barnes, Robert Coffin, and Reginald Breeze, voiced a range of concerns.
Problem gambling, as described by mental health professionals, is a very serious addiction, resulting in bankruptcy, divorce, criminal activity, and suicide.
We will have an indirect loss of lottery dollars. And as you know, the lottery dollars help buttress the state budget.
If we start down the path of allowing tribes to build multiple casinos, we better get ready to see a casino on every corner.
There were other objections as well. Members of the Cow Creek Band of the Umpqua Tribe of Indians warned a casino in Medford would siphon off customers from the tribe's Seven Feathers Casino in Canyonville, about an hour north. Cow Creek Elder Vera Jones said the loss of revenue would be devastating.
The Coquille Tribe should not enrich itself at the expense of my tribe's welfare.
Coquille officials counter that the casino will bring jobs and have pledged to pay for municipal services and contribute to community charities. They say they've given more than $4.5 million to civic and charitable groups in Southern Oregon since 2001, and at the public hearing in Medford, a few business people from Coos Bay said the tribe's casino there is an economic blessing. But the Coquille's Judy Metcalf says the bottom line is that the casino proposal is well within the tribe's legal rights.
We're not doing anything that Congress hasn't designated us to do. Through our Restoration Act, they gave us the ability to pursue economic development in five counties, and that's what the tribe is doing.
The Restoration Act, Metcalf refers to, is a law Congress passed in 1989 that restored the Coquille's legal status as a tribal nation under federal law. During the 1950s, Congress had nullified the status of many of Oregon's tribes. In the act, Congress defined five counties, Coos, Curry, Lane, Douglas, and Jackson, in which the Coquille could acquire land and have the government take it into trust, in effect making it Indian land. Coquille Tribal Chair Brenda Mead says it comes down to a simple question.
Do we have the right to purchase land in any of our five counties and ask the federal government to put it in trust? Absolutely.
Whether the tribe's legal position is as solid as Mead believes it is open to question. But this is just one of the thorny issues the Coquille's casino proposal raises, some of which could have broad implications for tribal gaming in Oregon and across the country. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
The proposal is facing its first major legal hurdle, getting the federal government to grant the site trust status, making it Indian land. Whether the project gets the go-ahead may depend on how officials at the Bureau of Indian Affairs interpret the fine print of laws and agreements that go back decades.
First, some history. In the Northwest states and California, casinos can be operated only by Indian tribes and only on reservations or other Indian trust land. That's rooted in a 1987 U.S. Supreme Court decision limiting states' jurisdiction over tribal gambling. The following year, Congress responded by passing the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act.
That's the federal statute that sets out the whole structure of Indian gaming in the United States.
Howard Arnett is an adjunct professor teaching Indian law at the University of Oregon Law School. As Arnett explains, the act laid out two classes of casinos. Class 3 is your full-on Las Vegas-style casino with slots, blackjack, and so on. Class 2 casinos allow only bingo, pull tabs, or other games where players play against each other, not against the house. The casino the Coquel tribe wants to build in Medford is of the Class 2 variety. And Arnett says that limits the state's say-so.
Because the state has no role legally under the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act with regard to Class 2 gaming.
One objection that's been raised by casino opponents is that allowing the Coquel to have a second casino would violate the state's longstanding one tribe, one casino policy. The tribe already has a Class 3 casino on its reservation in North Bend. Arnett notes that each tribe in Oregon has signed a gaming compact with the state, an agreement that spells out how tribal gaming operations will be run. And he says,
to the extent there is a one casino per tribe policy, it's reflected in the compacts, and Class 2 is outside the compacts.
The Coquel maintain their compact doesn't limit them to one casino anyway.
Some tribes in Oregon may have made that deal with the governor. The Coquel tribe did not.
That's Judy Metcalf, CEO of the Coquel Economic Development Corporation. She points out that the gaming compact the tribe signed in 2000 with then-Governor John Kitzhaber barred them from seeking a second Class 3 casino for 5 years. That's long since expired. If the tribe did want another Class 3 casino, she says, the one tribe, one casino policy would not apply to them.
In fact, it says they will have the ability to negotiate for a second Class 3 within their compact.
So, given that the Coquel proposal is for a type of casino that state and local governments have no jurisdiction over, and given that the Medford site is in the five-county area in southern Oregon that Congress authorized the Coquel to do business in, is their Medford casino proposal a legal slam dunk? Coquel Tribal Chair Brenda Mead seems to think so.
Our Restoration Act defines our lands and our lands of interest. That is the agreement the federal government and the Coquel tribe agreed on, and that is the law that we have to operate under today.
Others see the legal picture as being less clear-cut. At a recent public hearing, John Huddle, deputy counsel for the city of Medford, pointed to another federal law.
The city of Medford espouses the two-part determination under 25 U.S.C. Section 2719, sub B, sub 1, sub A.
The city of Medford, Jackson County, and others who oppose the casino say the law that should apply in this case requires the U.S. Secretary of the Interior to consult local officials and nearby tribes and make two determinations, that the casino would be in the best interests of the tribe that's asking for it, and that it would not be detrimental to the surrounding community. This law also gives the governor veto rights. Former Governor John Kitzhaber strongly opposed the new Coquel Casino. A spokesperson for new governor Kate Brown says she hasn't had time to look into the issue yet. However the Bureau of Indian Affairs rules, the legal complexities of this case are likely to keep lawyers for all sides busy for years to come. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
The proposal has garnered plenty of opponents, but perhaps none as vociferous as the Cow Creek Band of the Umpqua Tribe of Indians. The Cow Creek have spent a lot of energy and money rallying opposition to the Coquel proposal. Liam Moriarty looks at how these two tribes came to be at loggerheads.
Coquel Tribal Chair Brenda Mead says, for the most part, her tribe's on good working terms with the Cow Creek Band.
We operate our housing programs together, our health centers. We are doing amazing things with diabetes prevention programs for Indian people. We disagree on this one economic development project.
The Cow Creek folks don't seem to have quite as cheery a view of intertribal relations with the Coquel.
It was as if someone came to our house and robbed our cupboards, and now they're inviting us to dinner.
Michael Rondo is tribal CEO for the Cow Creek. The tribe operates the Seven Feathers Casino in Canyonville, about an hour north of Medford on I-5. And Rondo says a new casino down the road will do real harm to his people.
If this casino is allowed to move forward in the Medford area, it will cost the Cow Creeks 500 jobs and half of our revenue.
Cow Creek Elder Vera Jones told a public hearing in February what that would mean for her tribe.
The loss of revenue would directly and severely impact services my tribe provides to its members, to our children, and to our elders.
Coquille officials dispute that analysis. The tribe's economic development head, Judy Metcalf, notes that the Coos tribe is building a Class 2 casino just down the road from the Coquille's casino in North Bend. The Coquille, she says, are embracing that new competition rather than fighting it.
We think that's going to be good for the community. It's going to make us do a better job at the service that we provide, and ultimately it gives the consumer a better choice.
A Cow Creek spokesperson responds that if the Coquille really aren't concerned about a new casino next door, they haven't crunched the numbers. With so much on the line, it shouldn't be surprising that both tribes are running vigorous PR campaigns. They have dueling websites, dueling billboards along the highway near the proposed casino site, and dueling ads.
More than 200 new jobs created in our area.
With an annual payroll of over $9.5 million.
Average salary and benefits of more than $41,000 per year.
People are talking about the Cedars at Bear Creek. Join the conversation at MedfordWinds.com.
The Coquille say their proposed casino will create 200 new jobs. They say their average wage will be $41,000. In reality, there will be no new jobs. There will be a redistribution of jobs as local lottery businesses close.
In early February, the Cow Creek ratcheted up the pressure by laying off more than 90 employees from their Seven Feathers Casino. They said the move was at least partly in response to the need to tighten their belts to save money for a protracted legal battle. Both sides say they regret that the situation has come to this. Coquille Chair Brenda Mead.
Tribe against tribe is not a good place for us. We are not interested in ever going to that place. We are here to take care of Indian people, and that's what we are going to do with this project.
The Cow Creek's Michael Rondo says his tribe didn't start this fight, but they're committed to seeing it through.
We have a duty as a tribal government to protect the assets of our tribe, and that's simply what we're doing.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs environmental review of the Coquille project isn't expected to be complete till well into 2016. Whatever the decision, there's likely to be a lot of legal wrangling before the fate of the Medford Casino is finally decided. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN in Astoria, 89.5 KTCB in Tillamook, streaming live on the web at coastradio.org, on your mobile device by using the TuneIn app. Quick look at today's weather. Clouds are going to roll in, bringing with them that slight chance of rain this afternoon. Highs will be around 60, nighttime lows around 45. Increasing chance of rain tomorrow with highs around 55. Mentally ill inmates are languishing in Washington jails. They wait weeks, even months, for evaluations to see if they're competent to stand trial. The state admits the wait times are excessive and indefensible. In Seattle, a class action lawsuit over the delays has gone to trial in federal court. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports.
Last September, a 26-year-old man named Bryce had a psychotic episode at his parents' house near Spokane.
He's threatening to kill himself.
Bryce's father, Barry.
Threatening to kill us.
This went on for hours.
The threats continued, and they come more and more vocal into a rage.
Barry and his wife, Nancy, agreed to tell their story if we only use their first names. Finally, that evening, the couple decided to call the police.
We needed help.
Nancy says she was alone in a bedroom.
Bryce came back into the house and said, I just cut off Dad's head, and now I'm going to do you.
She didn't believe him because she couldn't see any blood, but it was scary. Nancy escaped the house and called 911. Responding sheriff's deputies subdued Bryce with a taser and arrested him. He was booked into the Spokane County Jail for felony harassment.
From there, the troubles really began.
Bryce would remain locked up in jail for the next 5 months, much of that time in isolation. Eventually, a judge ordered an evaluation to see if Bryce was competent to stand trial. 7 days passed, then 14, 30. Finally, a state psychiatrist showed up at the jail to evaluate Bryce on the 43rd day.
I think it's very inappropriate.
Carrie Reardon is Bryce's public defender. She says delays like this are all too common.
It is a tragedy that we are letting people with mental health issues simply rot in jail.
The state's own records show that in eastern Washington, average wait times for competency evaluations are 50 to 60 days. It's much shorter in western Washington, 14 to 18 days, but even that exceeds the state's own performance target of 7 days. In December, a federal judge in Seattle found the delays unconstitutional and said they must stop. She found that some inmates were defecating on themselves and resorting to self-harm. Jane Byer is an assistant secretary at Washington's Department of Social and Health Services. She agrees that current wait times are not acceptable.
We do not think it is good practice for individuals to wait in jail for extended periods of time.
Byer says in recent years, her agency has been getting more and more requests from judges for competency evaluations. That's created another backlog of inmates waiting for treatment to try to get them well enough to stand trial.
During the time that this demand for service has gone up, our staffing and the number of beds at the state hospitals available to provide these services have remained unchanged.
That's about to change, though. Lawmakers and the governor recently gave the agency money to hire 3 new competency evaluators and open up 15 additional hospital beds. At the same time, the governor has just signed a law that mandates a new 14-day standard for DSHS to provide a competency evaluation to jail inmates. The federal trial in Seattle will determine whether that's fast enough. Last December, the judge in the case said wait times beyond 7 days are suspect. As for Bryce in the Spokane County Jail, his father says the weeks of solitary confinement took a toll.
When I did see him, I was alarmed. He was incoherent. He was rambling.
A few weeks ago, a judge found Bryce not competent to stand trial. The charges against him were dropped. He was moved to Eastern State Hospital. But doctors there determined he did not meet the criteria for involuntary treatment. Now the charges have been reinstated, and Bryce is once again locked up in the Spokane County Jail. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
The University of Oregon's possible violation of a student's privacy when it accessed her therapy records has garnered national attention. This week, Oregon's congressional delegation got involved. KLCC's Rachel McDonald has more.
U.S. Senator Ron Wyden and Representative Suzanne Bonamici both sent letters to the Federal Department of Education citing concern over the breach of privacy. The U of O procured records from the campus counseling center belonging to a young woman who alleges she was sexually assaulted by 3 basketball players last spring. The student is suing the university. Jennifer Fried is a professor of psychology at the U of O.
From what we can understand that happened, it seems something broke down, and the consequence is a very severe lack of trust in both the university's counseling center as well as alarm around the country that this could happen on other campuses.
Fried wrote a resolution passed this week by the University Senate demanding that the records be returned. It also called for clarifying policy that would, as she says, hopefully make it possible for this to never happen again. Rachel McDonald, KLCC News.
You might think that a bill that would outlaw something that doesn't even take place in Oregon might sail through the legislature, but that isn't the case for a measure that would prohibit greyhound racing. The sport died out more than a decade ago in the state, but an attempt to ban it for good is having trouble getting across the finish line. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
Out of the gate, the bill looked like a winner. Democratic State Rep. Shamia Fagan told her colleagues on the House Business and Labor Committee she was sponsoring a bill to ban greyhound racing on behalf of 2 very important constituents, her dogs. One is named Maggie.
Also known in our house as Magaroo, Magaroo, Magaroo-roo-roo, Magaroo, Magaroo, Magaroodle-doo, and Loki, also known as the god of mischief, or also known as Big Old Nugs.
Maggie and Loki aren't greyhounds, but Fagan says it's her love of dogs that led her to sponsor the bill to ban greyhound racing. Later came Scott Beckstead. He's a lobbyist for the Humane Society of the United States. His testimony had a sharper edge. He told lawmakers that greyhound racing is unimaginably cruel and described industry practices that he said led to massive death and suffering by greyhounds. And he said the people who like the sport aren't that great either.
The crowd that tends to frequent dog tracks is a notoriously rougher crowd than what you see at the horse tracks.
It turns out at least two of the lawmakers on the committee used to attend races at the now-shuttered Greyhound track just outside of Portland. Some of them even put down a bet now and then. This is Democrat Margaret Doherty.
I actually got tuition to go to school one evening at the Greyhound, the Multnomah Kennel Club.
For the bill, that testimony could have been a bit of a stumble, but a few weeks later it was back on track, headed for a vote. Then Representative Doherty wavered. She called the measure a solution, looking for a problem. And she didn't want a yes vote to make it sound like she was against greyhound racing.
To characterize this as a humane bill that is, you know, the savior of animals and this kind of thing would absolutely be wrong and untruthful.
But Humane Society lobbyist Scott Beckstead insisted it was about saving dogs. He once again listed a litany of grievances against the racing industry. And then GOP Representative Jim Widener challenged Beckstead's claims from the first hearing.
When you came in and you lied to us earlier with your testimony for us to believe.
Committee Chair Paul Holvey called Widener out of order.
You cannot impugn somebody's integrity by saying they are a liar. He may interpret facts differently than others, but you do not call people liars in this committee.
Holvey called for a break in the hearing, and when the committee came back, the measure that would ban greyhound racing in Oregon was gone. Its sponsor, Shamia Fagan, thinks she knows why.
Suddenly the bill became about that person's testimony instead of about the fact that we should join 39 other states in banning this, you know, this form of gambling in Oregon.
Fagan says it's not clear whether the measure will be resurrected, but she says perhaps it doesn't matter that much after all.
Because we haven't had a greyhound track operable in 10 years, there won't be greyhound racing in Oregon, whether this bill passes or not. So we were just trying to actually take it specifically off the books, the statute that allowed greyhound racing.
The racing industry never sent anyone to Salem to testify against the bill. The National Greyhound Association submitted a letter suggesting that the measure was a thinly veiled attempt by anti-racing groups to put pressure on lawmakers in the handful of states where racing still exists. The nearest state with an active greyhound track is Arizona. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
A federal judge has sided with environmental groups and the Spokane tribe in a case concerning pollution in the Spokane River. Steve Jackson reports.
The case involves chemicals called PCBs that have been linked to cancer and liver dysfunction for several years. While the products were banned in manufacturing since the 1970s, they still remain in the environment. The Center for Environmental Law and Policy says the state and federal EPA failed to develop a policy for cleaning up PCBs from the river. On Monday, a federal court agreed with that assessment. The center's Rachel Pascal Osborne says in 2011, the Washington Department of Ecology reversed course and abandoned efforts to develop a PCB cleanup plan, largely because of political opposition by Spokane River polluters. But the judge determined that the EPA abused its discretion in agreeing to allow the committee process substitute for a cleanup plan.
The Spokane River is the most polluted river in the state when it comes to PCBs, and this is a really important public health issue, especially for people that fish and eat fish out of the river. And that includes immigrant communities and, of course, Spokane tribal members.
Monday's court decision orders EPA to come up with a total maximum daily load, or TMDL, for PCBs entering the river, which is a limit on how much can be released. Pascal Osborne is aware that tracking down many of the sources of PCBs may be difficult, but says many sources are known, including the county's newest wastewater treatment plant.
Clearly, the city of Spokane is a huge contributor, both through its pipes out at the plant and through the stormwater system. Inland Empire Paper is an active discharger of PCBs. And then we have historic PCBs at the Kaiser site.
The ruling calls for EPA to work with the Ecology Department to report back to the court within 120 days with a specific plan to complete a PCB TMDL. Department of Ecology spokeswoman Brooke Beeler said, quote, "We are making progress on identifying sources of PCBs and will continue to work with the community to reduce their impact on the Spokane River without a PCB water quality improvement plan in place." She says they are currently reviewing the decision to determine how it affects their work and evaluate their next steps. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
And that's about all the time we have for The Bridge, a weekly news presentation of Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul. Be sure to tune in next Thursday morning at 9 for another edition of The Bridge.